Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everyone. On behalf of the Tattered Cover Bookstore, it's my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for your support. A former National Book Award finalist and winner of the Edgar Allan Poe Award, Jess Walter is the author of six novels and one nonfiction book. His essays, criticism, and journalism have been widely published, and his work has been translated into more than 20 languages. If you haven't read The Beautiful Ruins yet, I'm so excited for you. Jess is such an alluring writer that you quickly form a deep emotional bond with all of his characters. In Beautiful Ruins, these characters are placed in a finely crafted, imaginative epic. I find myself devouring the book and then forcing myself to slow down as I reached the extremely satisfying conclusion because I simply did not want it to end. Would you please join me now in congratulating Jess Walter on his latest bestseller and welcoming him back to the Tattered Cover.
Thanks, Charles. Thanks for everyone for coming out. I did fly west from Toronto, where I was watching the cancellations at the airport right before I left. And when I landed in Denver, the first thing I asked was where the orgies are. But it turns out it's not that kind of swing state. So, and then I know there are some other writers in the crowd, and publishers really want you to tweet now. And I can never think of anything pithy and short to tweet, and so I tweeted that. And an hour later, my daughter called me and said, "Gross." So I really was not looking for orgies. I just thought it was kind of a funny joke. I started touring with this book when it came out in June, and I didn't make it to Denver, which is one of my favorite cities. And so I was asked to come speak at Colorado College, and I thought, what a great chance to sneak one more reading in. And so this is actually my last official event of the Beautiful Ruins tour. So we're closing it out here. Thank you. Yeah. And you start out, you love these books so much, and then, you know, when you go around and talk about them, you're so deep into the next book. I have a book of short stories coming out in February, and so I've been working on that, and I've got the next novel that I'm up to my corduroy elbow patches in. And so as you're working on the next thing and you have to go out and talk about the old thing, it's great, but still it's sort of like going to your ex-in-laws for dinner every other night. You know, it's like, yeah, she's great, and you're just like thinking about the next one. But this one has been really fun to go around and talk about. And after 30 or some readings, I start to feel like a Jess Walter cover band. So if you've heard me and heard any of these jokes before, I apologize. I got to sign at a Costco store recently, which is for a lover of independent bookstores like me is a peculiar hell. There's this long table, and they set you there and they stack all the books up, and you realize that people don't have any idea who you are, but they buy the book anyway because they're in such a purchasing mood in Costco. They would buy Social Diseases if you were selling them. And it seemed so impersonal and so strange that I had this brilliant idea. I cut the book into little sentences and I put them on napkins. And I gave little samples out like they do at Costco, you know, and which seemed to me like what you should do at Costco. Like, hey, you know, you should try this sentence. The whole book tastes like this. And like, you know, little kids that come by say, there's some bad words, or this is a spicy sentence. You better get your mom. And in Costco, nobody thought that was funny except me. So it's great to be in one of the best bookstores in America. I love Tattered Cover. It's one of those places, like a baseball fan, you know, this is this and Powell's, and some of those great stores are our Wrigley and our Fenway. So it's great to be here. I'm just going to read from the beginning so I don't have to do any of that goofball setup where I say, Natalie is a lesbian, but she doesn't know it yet. So if I read from the top, then we're both starting at the same place. So I'm just going to start with the beginning. Chapter 1, The Dying Actress, April 1962, Porta Vergogna, Italy. The dying actress arrived in his village the only way one could come directly, in a boat that motored into the cove, lurched past the rock jetty, and bumped against the end of the pier. She wavered a moment in the boat's stern, then extended a slender hand to grip the mahogany railing. With the other, she pressed a wide-brimmed hat against her head. All around her, shards of sunlight broke on the flickering waves. 20 meters away, Pasquale Tursi watched the arrival of the woman as if in a dream, or rather, he would think later, a dream's opposite, a burst of clarity after a lifetime of sleep. Pasquale straightened and stopped what he was doing, what he was usually doing that spring, trying to construct a beach below his family's empty pensione. Chest deep in the cold Ligurian sea, Pasquale was tossing rocks the size of cats in an attempt to fortify the breakwater, to keep the waves from hauling away his little mound of construction sand. The town's name, Porta Vergogna, meant Port of Shame, and was a remnant from the founding of the village in the 17th century as a place for sailors and fishermen to find women of a certain moral and commercial flexibility. It was a tight cluster of a dozen old whitewashed houses, an abandoned chapel, and the town's only commercial interest, the tiny hotel and cafe owned by Pasquale's family, all huddled like a herd of sleeping goats in a crease in the sheer cliffs. Beneath the village, the rocks rose 600 feet to a wall of black striated mountains. Below it, the sea settled in a rocky, shrimp-curled cove from which the fishermen put in and out every day. Isolated by the cliffs behind and the sea in front, the village had never been accessible by car or cart, and so the streets, such as they were, consisted of a few narrow pathways between the houses, brick-lined roads skinnier than sidewalks, plunging alleys and rising staircases so narrow that unless one was standing in the Piazza San Pietro, the tiny town square, it was possible anywhere in the village to reach out and touch walls on either side. In this way, remote Porta Vergogna was not so different from the quaint cliffside towns of the Cinque Terre to the north, except that it was smaller, more remote, and not as picturesque. In fact, the hoteliers to the north had their own pet name for the tiny village pinched into the vertical cliff seam, Baldracca Culo, the Whore's Crack. Yet despite his neighbor's disdain, Pasquale had come to believe that Porta Vergogna could someday flourish, but to do that it would need, first of all, a beach. And so Pasquale stood half-submerged, holding a big rock beneath his chin as the red mahogany boat bobbed into his cove. His old friend Lorenzo was piloting it for the wealthy vintner Gualfredo, who ran the tourism south of Genoa, but whose fancy 10-meter sport boat rarely came to Porta Vergogna. Pasquale watched the boat settle in its chop and could think of nothing to do but call out, "Orenzio!" His friend was confused by the greeting. They had been friends since they were 12, but they were not yellers, he and Pasquale, more acknowledgers, lip-raisers, eyebrow-tippers. Orenzio nodded back grimly. He was serious when he had tourists in his boat, especially Americans. "They are serious people, Americans," Orenzio had explained to Pasquale once, "even more suspicious than Germans. If you smile too much, Americans assume you're stealing from them." Today, Orenzio was especially dour-faced, shooting a glance toward the woman in the back of the boat, her long tan coat pulled tight around her thin waist, floppy hat covering most of her head. She was impossibly thin and yet amply curved, the beautiful American. From Pasquale's vantage in the sea, sun flickering behind her, wind snapping her blonde hair, it was as if she were another species, taller and more ethereal than any woman he'd ever seen. Orenzio offered her a hand, and after a moment of hesitation, she took it. He helped her from his boat onto the narrow pier. "Thank you," came an uncertain voice from beneath the hat, and then "grazie," the Italian word breathy and unpracticed. She took her first step toward the village, seemed to stagger a moment, and then regained her balance. It was then that she pulled off the hat to get a look at the village, and Pasquale saw her full features and was mildly surprised that the beautiful American wasn't, well, more beautiful. Oh, she was striking, certainly, but not in the way he'd expected. First, she was as tall as Pasquale, nearly 6 feet. And from where he stood, weren't her features a bit too much for such a narrow face? Plunging jawline so pronounced, mouth so full, eyes too thin, so that her eyes so round and open that she seemed startled? And could a woman be too thin, so that her curves seemed sudden, alarming? No, he thought, while she was striking, this was no great beauty. But then she turned directly to him, and the disparate features of her drastic face came together as a single perfect thing, and Pasquale recalled from his studies how some buildings in Florence could disappoint from various angles, and yet always presented well in relief, always photographed well, that the various vantages were made to be composed, and so too, he thought, some people. Then she smiled, and in that instant, if such a thing were possible, Pasquale fell in love. And he would remain in love for the rest of his life, not so much with the woman whom he didn't even know, but with the moment he dropped the rock he was holding. So that's Pasquale and D. At that moment, he falls for her in a way that is, I think, more existential than romantic. It's a moment that becomes so powerful to him that it threatens to sort of take over his life. And I was really interested in writing a sort of non-romantic romance. To think back to those moments in when you first met someone and the potential of a relationship was so incredibly powerful that everything you would do afterward would probably ruin it. And so then the question for me became, how long could that moment last between those two people? Pasquale finds out that this woman is named Dee Murray, that she's an actress, that she has been sent there by a man named Michael Dean. Michael Dean works for 20th Century Fox Pictures, and he's working on the film Cleopatra. And then the story, those two meet, and then the story picks up in the present day. And it sort of has those two rails. Those are the rails you follow the story on. In the present day, we pick up with Michael Dean, who's now a producer. And I'll read a quick description of Michael Dean because I like it. And because I'm the author and they gave me the microphone. Michael Dean is, this is him in the present day. Recently, Hollywood Hills, California. The Dean of Hollywood reclines in silk pajamas on a chaise on his lanai, sipping a fresca with ginseng and looking out over the hills to the glittering lights of Beverly Hills. The first impression one gets of Michael Dean is of a man constructed of wax, or perhaps prematurely embalmed. After all these years, it may be impossible to trace the sequence of facials, spa treatments, mud baths, cosmetic procedures, lifts and staples, collagen implants, outpatient touch-ups, tannings, Botox injections, cyst and growth removals, stem cell facial injections that have caused a 72-year-old man to have the face of a 9-year-old Filipino girl. Trying to picture what Michael Dean looked like as a young man in Italy 50 years ago, based on his appearance now, is like standing on Wall Street, trying to understand the topography of Manhattan Island before the Dutch arrived. So Michael Dean, as a producer and a former studio executive, in his office, a lot of what they do is hear pitches. This is his assistant, Claire, and it's her job basically to hear Michael's pitches for him. And this is the beginning of her chapter. Chapter 2, The Last Pitch, recently, Hollywood, California. Before sunrise, before Guatemalan gardeners in dirty dinged lawn trucks, before Caribbeans come to cook, clean, and clothe, before Montessori, Pilates, and coffee bean, before Benz's and BMW's nose onto palm streets and the blue-toothed sharks resume their endless business, the gentrification of the American mind, there are the sprinklers, rising from the ground to spit spray the northwest corner of greater Los Angeles, airport to the hills, downtown to the beaches, the slumbering rubble of the entertainment regime. In Santa Monica, they call to Claire Silver in the pre-dawn quiet of her condo, "Psst, hey!" Her curly red hair splayed out on the pillow like a suicide. They whisper again, "Psst, hey!" And Claire's eyelids flutter. She inhales, orients, glances over at the marbled shoulder of her boyfriend, sprawled asleep on his 70% of the king size. Daryl often cracks the bedroom window behind their bed when he comes in late, and Claire wakes like this, "Psst, hey," to water spritzing the rock garden outside. She's asked the condo manager why it's necessary to water a bed of rocks every day at 5 a.m., or at all for that matter, but that's not the real issue. Claire wakes jonesing for data. She fumbles the crowded bedside table for her BlackBerry, takes a digital hit. 14 emails, 6 tweets, 5 friend requests, 3 texts, and her calendar, a life in a palm. General stuff, too. It's Friday, 66 on the way to 74. 5 phone calls are scheduled for today, 6 pitch meetings. Claire is the chief development assistant for the legendary film producer Michael Dean. The title's phony. Her job's all assisting, no developing, and she's nobody's chief. She tends Michael's whims, answers his calls and emails, goes for his sandwiches and coffee, and mostly she reads for him. Great herds of scripts and synopses, one-sheets and treatments, a stampede of material going nowhere. She'd hoped for so much more when she quit her doctoral film studies program and went to work for the man who was known in the 70s and 80s as the Dean of Hollywood. She'd wanted to make movies, smart, moving films, but when she arrived 3 years ago, Michael Dean was in the worst slump of his career, with no recent credits except the indie zombie bomb Night Ravagers. In Claire's 3 years, Dean Productions has made no other movies. In fact, its only other production has been a single television program, the hit reality dating show and dating website hookbook.net. And with the monstrous success of that cross-media abomination, movies have become a fading memory at Dean Productions. Instead, Claire's days are spent listening to TV pitches so offensive, she fears she is single-handedly hastening the apocalypse. Model behavior. We take 7 models and put them in a frat house. And nympho night. We film the dates of people diagnosed with sex addiction. And drunk midget house. See, it's a house full of drunk midgets. Claire rises and stretches, starts for the bathroom. But on the way, she pauses over Daryl's jeans, which sit like a resting dancer on the floor right where he stepped out of them. Psst, don't, the sprinklers warn. But what choice does she have, really? A woman at the crossroads on the lookout for signs. She bends, picks up the jeans, goes through the pockets, 6 singles, coins, a book of matches, and ah, here it is, a punch card for something charmingly called Ass-tacular, the Southland's finest in live nude entertainment. Daryl's diversion. She turns the card over. Claire doesn't have much of an instinct for the gradations of the adult entertainment industry, but she imagines the employment of punch cards doesn't exactly distinguish Ass-tacular as the Four Seasons. Oh, and look, Daryl is just 2 punches from a free lap dance. How excellent for him. She leaves the card next to the snoring Daryl on her pillow in the indentation left by her head. Then Claire starts for the bathroom, officially adding Daryl to her deal with fate, like a hostage. Bring me a great film idea today, or the strip-clubbing boyfriend gets it. And that's when a single wistful thought escapes her otherwise made-up mind, a wish, or maybe a prayer, that amid today's crap she might just hear one decent pitch, one idea for a great film, so she won't have to quit the only job she's ever wanted in her entire life. Outside, the sprinklers spit laughter against the rock garden. So at work that day, Claire is going to hear a bunch of pitches, some from lunatics and others from Hollywood producers, not that those are mutually exclusive. And she's going to hear some reality pitches, and then an old Italian man is going to come into the office, and he's going to pitch a story about an actress who arrives in his village in 1962. And after a few minutes of listening to the pitch, it's going to dawn on Claire that this isn't a pitch, and that it's Pasquale Tursi, the man we've met from the first chapter, who's come to find this woman that he met 50 years earlier. The novel pretty much proceeds from those 2 points. My favorite part of all readings is questions and answers. So I'm gonna answer questions, but since no one ever wants to ask the first one, I'm gonna ask the first question that everyone asks, which is, where in the hell did this story come from? I was introduced at one reading, someone in the HarperCollins publicity department had sent out the phrase, in his most romantic novel yet, which is sort of like saying, with Denny's most gourmet meal ever. because this was my first romantic novel yet. And the story, it's funny because that seems, there are a lot of questions that circle around to the idea of where a novel comes from. And with this book, it's a fairly straightforward question because it's a book about Italy in 1962 and the movie Cleopatra, the actor Richard Burton, the Donner Party, Hollywood, reality television, Seattle grunge musicians, am I forgetting anything? The Edinburgh Film Fringe Festival. And so the way all those things came about is so impossible to track that I think whenever anyone asks where my ideas come from, I'm just going to give them this book because they come from so many disparate places. And the path of this book is one that I repeat with great pain because I hate when authors say a couple of different things, those sort of tropes and cliches. One, this book took me 15 years to write, which just, you know, propagates that old cliche of the writer locked away in some dark room. I remember a famous story of Jonathan Franzen blindfolding himself for 7 years and writing the corrections, which unless he has better control of the home keys than I do, I just don't find it believable. But so I hate when people say, you know, this book took me 15 years or took me 7 years, because any author knows that in those 15 years, there's 3 years of writing, 9 years of self-loathing and rehab, you know, maybe a year of watching TV and pretending to be writing, lots of emailing time, drinking. And the other trope that I hate is when people say the characters rose up and acted on their own. And I'm partly convinced authors do this to convince civilians not to try to become novelists because we are so incredibly petty and competitive. And if you're all out there doing it, then you'll find out just how easy and fun it is. And pretty soon we won't be as special because the characters don't get up and act on their own. I tried that. I would create these characters, Mike and Joanna, and I would wait for them to do something. And Mike would watch TV and Joanna would go get a cup of tea. And then a day would pass and Mike would watch some more TV. And the characters, you really do have to move them around. So if you just type their names and wait for them to happen, you really, nothing will happen. So all that said, it pains me to say this book took me 15 years to write, and that I only finished it when the characters got up and acted on their own. But it's strangely and bizarrely true. 15 years because I started it in 1997 when I went to Italy for the first time. My wife is third generation Italian, and we visited relatives up and down the boot. And we stumbled into the Cinque Terre. And being a kid from Spokane, Washington, I knew only one thing about writing, and that was that no one would ever want to read a novel based in Spokane, Washington. So I was constantly looking for a place. And when I first stumbled into the Cinque Terre, I thought, this is such a romantic, incredible place. I want to write about this. I immediately started a novel. My mother had been diagnosed with cancer, and I had recently become so interested in her past and in the choices that she wasn't allowed to make in her life. I come from a very blue-collar family. No one in my family had gone to college, had graduated from college. We weren't readers, and yet I had this. All of us kids had this facility, this capacity for language. And when I went back and read my mom's old school papers, they were impeccable. They were perfect. She had perfect pitch as a writer. And yet she never had the opportunity to do those things. So when she died of cancer, my first impulse was to send a woman about her age to Italy. So the very first thing I wrote was this beginning, the dying woman arrived in Italy, arrived in his village, the only way one could arrive directly. And then I got stuck. I had Pasquale, I had these two characters, and nothing would happen. I had my Joanna and my Mike, and they just sat there. So I set the book down and I wrote another novel. And when I finished it, I went back to Beautiful Ruins and I thought, what do you do when you've got one chapter and you're stuck? So I wrote a chapter about a novelist named Alvis Bender who's stuck with one chapter. And then I got stuck again. And this lather, rinse, repeat, this process repeated itself over the years. I wrote 5 novels while this one failed me every time. And every time I would come back to it, I'd be drawn back to the characters. And I would imagine that they had been sitting there waiting for me to put them back into action. So after several years, I finally finished a draft and I thought, I've done it. I finished this book. And as those of you who are writers know, you have to have a first reader. And it used to be my wife. She was a newspaper editor, was a very valuable first reader until I gave her, with great pageantry, the first chapter of a novel one time. And I said, just let me know what you think. She said, of course, of course. And I went to the bathroom and I came back in and she was reading Bel Canto. So she was cut off from that point on. So I had another first reader, and I gave him the newly finished Beautiful Ruins, and I said, I think I finally got this. And if you know anything about a first reader, it's that they have to know, even if you've given them total crap, that the first thing out of their mouth is, this is really good. And so my first reader said, you don't have this. And I have not spoken to him since. No, we're still friends. But he was right. And to realize I had worked on this book at that point for 10 or 11 years, and every time I set it down, I didn't think, oh, I'll finish this some other time and it'll do really well. I thought, it's dead. You know, it's like so many of the things I write. A good writer hits about what a second baseman in the 70s hit, right around 270. So about 27% of what I write works, and the rest are strikeouts and weak fly balls. So I thought this was a weak fly ball, and oh well. So I set it down thinking I was done with it, and I thought, I want to write something very different. So I wrote The Financial Lives of the Poets. And I wrote it in a kind of 8-month burst, faster than any book has ever come to me. I wrote it in first person to be totally different from this book. Often I feel like I'm writing something to get the taste of the last one out of my mouth. So I write something very different than the last time. So I did that, finished Financial Lives of the Poets. It ended up doing pretty well. And I went back to see, well, what else do I have? And I looked at Beautiful Ruins and it was just staring me in the face. And I knew one thing though. I knew to be reanimated with these characters, I would have to go back to Italy. And so I and the characters, all 38 of them, it was incredibly expensive, flew to Italy, and a friend of mine was teaching and he asked if I would lecture his students in Florence. So we spent some time in Florence, and then I went back to the Cinque Terre, and I was hiking along and I saw things I hadn't noticed before, like machine gun nests, which worked their way into the book, and all sorts of things. But I had this other thought too, that I'd been carrying these characters around so much, and the thing that hadn't worked in the book was the ending. I did not have the ending, and I just kept imagining the way I had carried these characters for so long, for 13 years by this point, and that I had sort of gently moved them throughout this whole story that comes at you from these different angles. And I thought, at the end, they have to just sort of be released like dandelion seeds. And somehow you have to have almost a film montage, since this is a very cinematic book, in which you get to see every character in present tense, as if all those moments, the very first moment that Pasquale has being such a key elemental moment for him, if the moment for each character exists in one continuous stream. And if you can do that, the novel will work. I keep a writing journal. I fill one up about every 3 months or so. And that night I was writing in my journal and I was writing what might happen to the characters and coming up with quick elaborations and this idea of the ending. And I looked up at one point, and the last thing I wrote among 36 pages of journal notes that night was, the sun came up, I wrote all night. And it was just one of those incredible bursts of, you know, of kind of epiphany, I guess, of connecting with the material. So I went back home, I let the characters finish the story, and I get to go around and say that I worked on a book for 15 years, even though I had 5 other books come out during that time. So now that I've answered that question, I'd love to answer any other questions. And if anyone does know where the orgies are, I was only half kidding about that. So. Yes.
Change. changes in a way that I found very touching, but he's not in the scene.
Right.
Could you talk about how you work with that a little bit?
They're recording this, so I'm going to repeat the questions. It's not that... So just in case you think I'm mocking you when I repeat the questions... the question was about Daryl, Claire's boyfriend, and his sort of existing off stage and then coming around in the end. I guess you don't really get to see what transformation he has. And I don't want to give away the ending, except that Daryl is a pretty minor character, and it ends with him carrying an engagement ring in his plum pants, if I'm not mistaken. So, it's funny because you start with these minor characters that you don't imagine are going to have too much to do with the book. And I was writing, if you're writing a book in which one of the things you're talking about is romance and people getting together, it felt like such a pull between Claire and Shane getting together. And I just didn't feel like they would, again, you get to know these people so well, and it just seemed wrong to me in some way. And Claire's big attraction to Daryl is that he's great in bed. Well, he's not actually great in bed. He's really good looking. In fact, she describes him in bed as 5 minutes with a clumsy gynecologist followed by a visit from the Roto-Rooter man. So he's actually not good in bed, but he should be. He looks like he should be. He's just built, and her physical attraction to him was the first thing that connected them. And we tend in fiction, I think, to dismiss that. And I wanted that to be, for them, powerful enough to keep them together through a kind of rocky time, through his going to strip clubs and hanging around the house, staring in the refrigerator, texting her, do we have cereal and things, So, and sometimes the characters will start out as sort of comic characters, and then I find myself just getting strange affection for them. Or someone like Michael Dean, who in the beginning was, felt to me like a kind of compilation of so many different kinds of directors and narcissists and egotists. And by the end, I think he's kind of the hero of the book. I think he's the one who pushes the action and drives these characters together and maybe has the only philosophy that makes any sense in the entire book, which is we want what we want, which all the characters prove over and over. Yes. Yes, back there. Sorry. Yeah, that's a great question. Do I write, looking for a message first, having something I want to say, and then craft a story around it? It's different every time, I will say. But another truism that is sad because it's so true is you write the book to discover what it is. I never know exactly what it is I want to say. With a book like The Financial Lives of the Poets, I knew I was writing about the recession. I knew I was writing about all these different things. I didn't know until I got into it that I was writing about how close the edge really is, and about our own personal responsibility. The way we live our lives, we have so much more gap between ourselves and real failure that, as a character says in that book, we always have pockets. Our hands aren't going to get cold even if we don't have gloves. And I discovered that at the very end. With Beautiful Ruins, I think, it was in that last round of writing after I came back from Italy the second time that I discovered this quote about Richard Burton that in an interview with Dick Cavett that he was a beautiful ruin. And when I saw that, it took my breath away because I thought, that's the book I've been writing for the last however many years. And these people are in a state of ruin, and yet I find great beauty in their failures. I find great beauty in their striving. And that's what the book, that's when I realized that's the story I've been trying to tell. Once that happens, I go back to the beginning, and I go back to the beginning relentlessly anyway. My books are very much, For you know, the beginning, I've written 45,000 times by the time I get to the end. I always, on Monday morning, I start at the beginning of whatever section I'm working on. Sometimes I won't write a new word until Tuesday or Wednesday. And I rework and rework and I read it aloud to myself. And so when those thematic things come to me, and I think I probably am pretty thematic as a writer. I don't feel like anything has come into real being until I've known what it is. And not that it has to give some lesson, because I really don't know anything, so I'm not one to impart lessons, but that it knows its material, it knows the question that it's asking, that it's posing about the world. And I think it's all part of that process, but I think I discover it along the way. It's probably easier to track, as everything is with short stories. I was working on a short story. I teach every once in a while, although they never ask me back. There's a kind of famous assignment to teach writers something that is, it's something writers hardly ever talk about and that you don't hear very much about, but writing is so often an act of empathy, of writing, of getting inside characters and really trying to know what they think and how they act and what they feel. And to do that, we often write stories that are personal because it's easier to do that. And one good thing to do with writing students is to cause them to write from other points of view that are not close to them, and to acquire the same sort of feeling that they do with themselves, with other people. So you can tell them that one version of this assignment is to say, take someone who's as far from you as you can and write about them. Another one is to say, take something you did that you're ashamed of and write about it from someone else's point of view. So if you broke up with someone in a really awful way, write the story about the girl who got the text breaking up with her. And in that way, you're seeing your own actions from somewhere else. Well, I'd given this assignment a few times, and one time I thought, I should do this. And so I quickly flashed to how when I was a kid, my dad worked in an aluminum plant, and when he got home every night, he dumped change in this big change jar. And when the jar, the big whiskey jug was full, we got to go on vacation. And it took about 2 years. So we got a vacation every 2 years. And this was a car trip up to Fred Flintstone Land in Kelowna, B.C. This was not to the Bahamas or something. Here's this just blue collar family saving for vacations, you know, a little bit of beer change at a time. And some shitheel kid in this family is going and stealing that money to buy baseball cards and then to buy beer and then to buy pot. And it was me. And so I decided I'd write this story from the father's point of view. And so I start writing the story, and it's going to be a detective story. And I think it's funny. It's a detective story. Which of my three kids is a sociopath? And so the dad is watching the kids, and he's trying to determine which one it is. And then he sets up this elaborate ruse where the mom's gone for the day, and he says he has to go to work. He works, as my dad did, in an aluminum plant. And so but instead of going to work, he goes and puts a sixer of Lucky Lagers in their tiny closet. And then he sneaks out the house, climbs through the window, and sits in the closet and drinks those beers next to where he keeps the whiskey jug of change until someone is going to come and steal that money. And the dad's sitting there, and I'm writing, and it's all going along fine. I'm thinking, what a swell story. And then the little me starts coming into the room to take the money. And there are the coveralls sitting there. And the dad's behind the coveralls. They're like a curtain, you know, those big work coveralls you wear. And the dad reaches out to grab the coveralls. And I swear I did not know this until it happened. I realized, as a father now, I would not want to know. I would not pull those coveralls back. I would let whichever kid was going to be the sociopath take the money, and I would want to love my kids, and so I would not want to know which one was the thief. So the dad sits there, and he just lets go and keeps drinking beer. And at that moment, I thought, oh my God, this is a story about dads. This is not a murder mystery. This is a story about how we want our kids to be so much better than us than that we will it to happen. So that's often how the process happens for me. Often I don't come up with some great idea and I fumble around in the dark. But usually on the things that work, it's some 11th hour thing that tells me this is what it is. And then it's all revision. Then I had to go back and make that story about that. And that, I think that's what happens with the novels too. Yes.
That is such a fabulous
movie. Oh, thanks. And you got it for free. I just unsold a bunch of copies of my short story collection. That's actually, it is going to be in there. Yeah, I do. I have a long relationship with short stories. I love them, and they didn't like me for very long. You're supposed to start with short stories as a writer, and my form was always the novel. I did write short stories, but back then when I started writing stories, which was in the late 80s, early 90s, you had to send them through. You'd have to put them in an envelope, fold up another envelope, put it in, put postage on the other envelope. It was like $4,000 by the time you got done. And then you'd mail it off to New York, and then like a Manila boomerang, it would come flying back to you 6 weeks later with a rejection letter. And for years, the stories I wrote were rejected. And I thought they were pretty good. But I know you would have. And so I'd published two novels, and I'd published a couple of stories, but my best stories kept getting rejected. So I had this brilliant idea, and I told my editor, let's publish a book of short stories. And my best story at the time was called Sex Talk. And it was also sort of based on a true story. My dad came home drunk one night and gave me an entirely inappropriate sex talk that was more like stereo instructions. This goes here and don't do that or you'll have it blow up. In the story, I made the kid eight. And so, I mean, totally inappropriate sex talk story. So I wrote this story, Sex Talk, and I did what I do once a year, which is send it to the New Yorker, and got a rejection, sent it to a few other places. And I finally told my editor, if they're not going to publish, this is a great story. If they're not going to publish this, then let's publish a book called Sex Talk and Other Rejected Short Stories. And then on the back, we'll put all those notes, those mean notes I've gotten, including one that said, you write pretty well, but as literature, I think not, which would be a great blurb on the back of this book. Thankfully, my editor said no, and then I kept writing short stories, and then McSweeney's would take one, and Harper's would take one, and Playboy, and then I looked up. I was sort of just had my nose down working on novels, and I looked up and I realized I'd published about 30 short stories. And so my editor said, it's probably time for a collection. I said, it is time for a collection. So I started putting it together, and I went back and looked at Sex Talk, and it just doesn't belong. It's the best story I wrote in those first years, and it's not as good as any of the stories I've written recently. And I was so thrilled by this because, like little kids, you know, who can't see the way we grow unless we, you know, use a pencil on the wall, we don't know that we get better as writers. And it was thrilling to see that not only are readers apparently getting smarter and reading my stuff, but I'm getting better. And so that was really encouraging to see. So the book is called We Live in Water, and it comes out in February. So, yeah. And I've only given away one of the endings of the stories. The rest are going to be fabulous. Other questions? Yes. The first book that made an impression on me, well, Treasure Island first, because I got a stick in this eye when I was five. So when you wear an eye patch from age 5 to age 9, you love all things pirate. So it makes Halloween really easy, and you love all things pirate. But the first novel was Kurt Vonnegut's Breakfast of Champions. And I've told the story. I'm actually in Kurt Vonnegut's biography that Charles Shields wrote. I've told this story so many times. But when I was a little kid, I used to go to my middle school library and look to see where my novels would be filed when I was an adult, because I was so sure I'd be a writer. And right before Walter in my school library was Vonnegut. And so I grabbed Breakfast of Champions and I took it home. And if you've read that book, it's Vonnegut's 50th birthday present to himself. And he says, when Jefferson turned 50, he freed his slaves. When Tolstoy turned 50, he freed his slaves. As I'm turning 50, I'm going to go inside my own book and free my characters. And I remember thinking, you can do that? And then I turned to page 8, and there Vonnegut said, and also I like to draw pictures, and here is my picture of an asshole. And he drew an asterisk. And never having seen one, I thought, is that what they look like? I suppose it is. And being a 13-year-old boy, I thought, you can do that? And Vonnegut just showed me that you could, that this was like a three-dimensional thing. You could move it and manipulate it. It wasn't just a narrative that went from beginning to end. The language had a sound that was like music, and the theme was that we should be better people, that we should be good to one another, that we can that you know, humanity has hope if it does better. These were amazing things to see that a writer could do, and I gobbled up everything Vonnegut read. A few years later, when I was a young father and working in a newspaper and certain that I would never be a novelist, I had this great idea that I would, rather than learn to write myself, that I would sort of stalk writers, and through a process like osmosis, their genius would rub off on me. So because I had journalism training and was a college student at the time, I got phony press credentials to hear some of my favorite authors read. So the first one was Ken Kesey. Ken Kesey came to my hometown. I was a huge fan of One Flew the Cuckoo's Nest and Sometimes a Great Notion. And so when Kesey came, I got phony press credentials, and I went. And the way these things were run, they'd get four or five reporters together, and we'd ask our questions, and then they'd do their reading. So I sat with the other reporters, and I raised my hand and asked my little question, "What advice would you give to a young writer?" And Kesey had just lost his son in a bus accident, and he was really just wanted to talk about bus safety, which made perfect sense. But I remember thinking, oh, these writers are people too. Was kind of my first inkling of that. The next writer I stalked was Tom Wolfe, who also came to Spokane to read at Gonzaga University. And so I did the same thing. I got my phony press credentials. I sat in front and asked my question, "What advice would you give to a young writer?" And, you know, Tom Wolfe, with his high collar and imperious tone, said, "Use a word processor." Which tells you how old I am and what a jackass Tom Wolfe was. And then the third writer to come to my hometown was Kurt Vonnegut. And so I did the same thing. You know, I wrote for phony press credentials, and I showed up at Gonzaga for the reading, and there were no other reporters. It was just me and Kurt Vonnegut sitting in a room across from each other. And so imagine you're sitting, you know, growing up in a blue-collar family, not knowing any writers. I had made him into my mentor without ever letting him know. And so I'm sitting across from, you know, the reason that I want to be a writer, the voice that I want to have as an author. And he's sort of looking at me. He's tired. He's traveled all day. And I said, "Well, if you were going to give advice to a young writer," and he's kind of looking at me, he says, "Can I ask you a question? How old are you?" And I said, "Well, I'm 20. And he said, "And you're writing for Esquire?" Which is what I'd told them. And I said, "Well, they haven't actually accepted it yet." And each time I'd sort of elevated the... because I didn't want to not get Vonnegut tickets. So he said, "And what was your question?" And so for about 15 minutes, we talked about it. And he gave the advice I would give, which is you just work. You work, you develop your voice. You know, you work inside yourself to reach other people. And that's what he did. He wrote ad copy, and then he started writing short stories, and then he developed a voice as a novelist. And so after that, you know, we talked for 15 or 20 minutes, and he said, "I'm really tired. Is it all right if I get some rest before my reading?" I said, "Of course. I'm sorry. I've taken up enough of your time." He excused himself. At his reading that night, he went through his normal Vonnegut brilliance. And when he was done, I was sitting in the front row, and he spotted me, and he pointed and called me up. And I came up, and he said, "I'm sorry I had to excuse myself today, but did you get everything you needed?" I said, "I did, thank you." And it was clear I was not writing a piece for Esquire, but he said at the end, "Well, I look forward to reading it." So I wrote that in an essay a few years later. Vonnegut was coming back to Spokane, and I wrote a piece for an alternative magazine about stalking Kurt Vonnegut. And I ended the story with, you know, him saying, "I look forward to reading it," and me saying, "Well, Mr. Vonnegut, here it is." So the story's not even done. Then, in the meantime, I'd been writing all these novels, and I had three books out by that point, and that story runs, and I go out to get the mail one day, and there's a brown manila envelope, and I first thing I smell is cigarette smoke. And Vonnegut spent his whole life smoking Pall Malls. In fact, he threatened to sue the tobacco companies for not killing him in a timely manner. And I can smell the cigarette smoke, and I see up in the corner Vonnegut, 48th Street, New York, and I go, "No!" And I tear it open, and it's a leather-bound copy of The Sirens of Titan. And on the inside, it says, "To my fellow novelist, Jess Walter, this is the one novel of mine that wrote itself. All the others refused. Yours, Kurt Vonnegut." And I was just like, oh, my God. And I had just finished my novel, Citizen Vince. So I immediately sent it off to him with a thank you note. And 3 weeks later, I got a little postcard. And on the front, it said, "Life is a terrible thing to do to an animal, Kilgore Trout." And on the back, it said, "Dear Jess, read Citizen Vince right away. Really liked it. So glad you're being noticed. Your friend, Kurt Vonnegut." And I thought, oh, my God, I have a correspondence with Kurt Vonnegut. But the and every correspondence has its own rules, and this one required me to write a book and him to write a postcard, which seemed totally fair to me. So as I was writing The Zero, which is a dark satire about our reaction to terrorism, I kept imagining I was wearing a What Would Vonnegut Do bracelet. This is what Vonnegut would make of the world we found ourselves in. And so with great pride, I boxed the book up and sent it to him. And I got a really nice card back from him saying, read The Zero. It's wonderful. Congratulations. And the last bit of it said, there's a, the Zero has an epigraph from Celine and it, and, he wrote, do you know what Celine said about the Nobel Prize? How come every chap ass in Europe has one? Where's mine? And then Vonnegut died not long after that. But it was such a perfectly round correspondence. And every time my editors would ask, do you know anyone that can give a blurb? I would never rat out Vonnegut because I felt like I'd already bothered him enough. And I've already bothered you all enough. So I'm going to sign books now and answer any other questions at the table here. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.